available in the clubroom, Schreiber claimed, making the notorious Lubanka prison sound like an aristocratic men's club as opposed to the draconian penal institution that it was. I had to wait and see whether this court itself might not raise the question of bacteriological warfare, Schreiber said. When I saw that it did not raise this question, I decided in April to make this statement. Witness, said General Alexandrov, will you kindly tell us what you know about the preparations by the German High Command for bacteriological warfare? In July 1943, the High Command of the Wehrmacht called a secret conference, in which I took part as representative of the Army Medical Inspectorate, said Schreiber. A bacteriological warfare group was formed at this meeting. As a result of the war situation, the High Command authorities now had to take a different view of the question of the use of bacteria as a weapon in warfare, from the one held up till now by the Army Medical Inspectorate, Schreiber testified. Consequently, the Führer, Adolf Hitler, had charged Reich Marshal Hermann Göring to direct the carrying out of all preparations for bacteriological warfare, and had given him the necessary powers, Schreiber said. In this statement, Schreiber was contradicting the generally accepted notion that Hitler had never authorized his generals to use chemical or biological weapons against Allied troops. In fact, no chemical or biological weapons were ever used in World War II, which made it strange that Schreiber had been brought all the way to Nuremberg to testify to something that was ultimately irrelevant to the war crimes trial. Why, then, was Schreiber really there? At this secret conference, it was decided that an institute should be created for the production of bacterial cultures on a large scale, Schreiber said, and the carrying out of scientific experiments to examine the possibilities of using bacteria in warfare. The institute was also to be used for experimenting with pests, which could be used against domestic animals and crops, and which were to be made available if they were found practicable. And what was done after that? Major General Alexandrov asked rather pointedly. A few days later, I learned that Reich Marshal Göring had appointed the deputy chief of the Reich Physicians League, Dr. Kurt Blomme, to carry out the work, and had told him to found the institute as quickly as possible in or near Posen. And what do you know about the experiments which were being carried out for the purpose of bacteriological warfare? General Alexandrov asked. Experiments were carried out at the institute in Posen, Schreiber said ominously, referring to Blomme's Institute for Plague Research. I do not know any details about them. I only know that aircraft were used for spraying tests with bacteria emulsion, and that insects harmful to plants, such as beetles, were experimented with. But I cannot give any details. I did not make experiments myself. Alexandrov asked if the Army High Command knew about these experiments. Schreiber replied, I assume so. Will you kindly tell us precisely what the reason was for the decision of the OKW to prepare for bacteriological warfare? Alexandrov asked. The defeat at Stalingrad, Schreiber said, led to a reassessment of the situation, and consequently to new decisions. It was no doubt considered whether new weapons could be used, which might still turn the tide of war in our favor. So why didn't the Reich use biological weapons? Alexandrov asked. Instead of answering the question, General Schreiber went into minute detail regarding a meeting in March 1945 with Dr. Blomme. In March 1945, Professor Blomme visited me at my office at the Military Medical Academy, Schreiber recalled. He had come from Posen and was very excited. He asked me whether I could accommodate him and his men in the laboratories at Sachsenburg, so that they could continue their work there. He had been forced out of his institute at Posen by the advance of the Red Army. He had had to flee from the institute, and he had not been able to blow it up. He was very worried at the fact that the installations for experiments on human beings at this institute, the purpose of which was obvious, might be easily recognized by the Russians for what they were. He had tried to have the institute destroyed by a Stutka bomb, but that, too, was not possible. Therefore, he asked me to see to it that he be permitted to continue work at Sachsenburg on his plague cultures, which he had saved, Schreiber said. Dr. Bloma wasn't on trial. Why was Schreiber spending so much of his testimony talking about Dr. Bloma? During his visit, Bloma told me that he could continue his work in an alternative laboratory in Gerberg, Thuringia, Schreiber said. But that this was not yet completed. It would take a few days or even a few weeks to complete it, and that he had to have accommodation until then. He added that if the plague bacteria were to be used when the military operations were so near to the borders of Germany, when units of the Red Army were already on German soil, it would, of course, be necessary to provide special protection for the troops and the civilian population. A serum had to be produced. Here again, time had been lost, and as a result of all these delays, it had never been possible to put the idea into effect. Was Schreiber's testimony focused against Dr. Kurt Bloma out of some kind of personal rivalry or vendetta? On the witness stand, Schreiber also fingered a number of other Reich medical doctors, none of whom was on trial. In addition to naming Kramer and Holzlerner as organizers of the freezing experiments, Schreiber said that a man called Dr. Ding had artificially infected KZ prisoners with typhus using typhus-infected lice, and that the talented surgeon Dr. Carl Gebhardt had carried out cranium operations on Russian prisoners of war and had killed the prisoners at certain intervals in order to observe the pathological changes. Schreiber testified that the defendant Göring had ordered these experiments and that Reichsführer SS Himmler had kindly made available the subjects for the experiments. But in a disproportionate amount of his testimony, Schreiber circled back to Dr. Bloma's plague research for the Reich. Dr. Hans Laternzer was given an opportunity to cross-examine the witness. Laternzer asked Schreiber if his testimony for the Russian assistant prosecutor was prepared. Schreiber said no. Was any advantage promised to you for making this report? Laternzer asked. No, nothing was promised me, and I would refuse to allow anybody to hold out advantages to me, Schreiber said. Well, let us assume that such a devilish idea as actually to use bacteria did exist. Would that not have involved your troops in serious danger? Laternzer asked. Not only our troops, but the whole German people. For the refugees were moving from east to west. The plague would have spread very swiftly to Germany. I have one more question, witness. Did you ever write down your objections to this bacteriological warfare? Dr. Laternzer asked. Schreiber said, yes, in the memorandum which I mentioned before. Dr. Laternzer asked, when did you submit that memorandum? In 1942, may I now? That is enough, Laternzer interrupted. He'd caught Schreiber in a lie. The conference took place in July 1943. Laternzer had no further questions. The tribunal adjourned. Perhaps embarrassed by the fact that their star witness had been caught in a lie, the Russians did not call Schreiber back to the stand. Dr. Alexander made yet another attempt to interview him, again without success. The Russians said they were sorry, but Dr. Schreiber had already been transported back to Moscow. It was a curious event, but something did result from Schreiber's bizarre testimony. 2 days later, a military vehicle pulled into the U.S. Army Military Intelligence Service Center at Darmstadt. where Bloma had been employed by the army as a post doctor. Dr. Bloma was arrested and taken to the prison complex at the Nuremberg Palace of Justice. A confidential change of status report now listed him as a prisoner in the custody of the 6850 Internal Security Detachment Nuremberg, where Colonel Burton Andrus served as prison commandant. Circumstance had altered Bloma's future. He was off the paperclip list and instead placed on a list of defendants who would face prosecution at the upcoming Nuremberg doctor's trial. 150 miles from Nuremberg, at the Army Air Force's classified research facility in Heidelberg, the massive undertaking forged ahead. For an entire year now, day in and day out, 58 German physicians in white lab coats had been working on an array of research projects in state-of-the-art laboratories, studying human endurance, night vision, blood dynamics, exposure to bomb blast, acoustic physiology, and more. They all reported to Dr. Strughold, who reported to the facility's commanding officer, Colonel Robert J. Benford. High-ranking military officers regularly visited the facility, including its two founders, General Malcolm Groh and Colonel Harry Armstrong. Groh was working in Washington, D.C. as the air surgeon, soon to be the first Surgeon General of the U.S. Air Force. Harry Armstrong had returned to Texas, where he was now Commandant of the School of Aviation Medicine, SAM, at Randolph Field. Working alongside the Nazi doctors in Heidelberg were dozens of Army translators preparing English-language versions of the physicians' reports. By September 1946, there were over 1,000 pages of documents completed. Soon, everything would be compiled into a 2-volume monograph for the Army Air Forces entitled German Aviation Medicine, World War II. Work progressed well for Strughold's staff of doctors in Heidelberg until the Institute was thrown into psychological chaos. On September 17, 1946, military security officers with the Counterintelligence Corps 303 Detachment arrived at the center with 5 arrest warrants in hand. Doctors Theodore Benzinger, Siegfried Ruf, Konrad Schaffer, Hermann Becker-Freising, and Oskar Schroeder were wanted by the International Military Tribunal, Nuremberg, for war crimes as suspect. The men were arrested and taken to the prison complex at the Nuremberg Palace of Justice, to the same wing where Dr. Bloma was already incarcerated. If any of this were to come to light, that the U.S. Army Air Forces had been employing war crimes suspects and had them conducting military research at a facility inside Germany, expressly prohibited by Allied peace agreements, Harry Armstrong's institute would be shut down, Operation Paperclip would be exposed, and the U.S. Army would have an international scandal on its hands. The Nazi doctor's trial was the first of the so-called subsequent trials to take place after the trial of the major war criminals at Nuremberg. It began on December 9, 1946. Unlike with the first trial, the 23 defendants at the doctor's trial, 20 doctors and 3 SS bureaucrats, were virtually unknown figures in the eyes of the American public. What was known, from earlier press coverage, was that these proceedings would put lurid Nazi science on trial. In the words of Chief Prosecutor General Telford Taylor, Nazi doctors had become proficient in the macabre science of killing. Torturous medical experiments conducted on concentration camp prisoners included freezing experiments, high-altitude tests, mustard gas research, seawater drinkability tests, malaria research, mass sterilization, and euthanasia. The New York Times called the doctor's crimes beyond the pale of even the most perverted medicine and cautioned that some details were difficult to report because they were impossible to comprehend. The New York Times cited one particularly grotesque example. Perfectly healthy people, Jews and Slavs, had been murdered at the request of SS physician Dr. August Hurt for a university skeleton collection of the Untermenschen. This was the same anatomist named by Dr. Eugen Hagen in papers discovered by Alsace officers in Strasbourg in November 1944. Hurt, an expert in dinosaur anatomy, had committed suicide before the trial. The defendants ran the gamut from the dregs of the German medical profession to doctors who had once been internationally esteemed, like Dr. Kurt Bloma. On October 12, 1946, the Stars and Stripes newspaper, which operated from inside the Pentagon, listed the individual names of the doctors charged, a list that included the five Luftwaffe doctors who had been arrested at the U.S. Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center: Theodore Benzinger, Siegfried Ruf, Konrad Schaffer, Hermann Becker-Freising, and Oskar Schroeder. In a matter of weeks, these physicians had gone from being employed by the U.S. Army to being tried by the U.S. military for war crimes. The ultimate judicial punishment was on the line. Each doctor faced a possible death sentence. The following week, inside the prison complex at the Nuremberg Palace of Justice, there was a strange occurrence involving Dr. Benzinger. In Benzinger's pre-trial investigation, he admitted being aware of the fact that medical experiments were taking place at concentration camps and that non-consenting test subjects had been murdered in the process. Benzinger also admitted that he had attended the October 1942 conference in Nuremberg, Medical Problems of Sea Distress and Winter Distress, where data from murdered people was openly discussed among 90 Luftwaffe doctors. During Benzinger's Nuremberg incarceration, prosecutors revealed to him that they had a new detail regarding his accessory to medical crimes, namely the motion picture of the record of the medical murder experiments that had been shown at a private screening at the Air Ministry. Benzinger did not deny that he had been one of a select group of doctors invited by Himmler to attend this film screening. Nor did he deny that he was one of nine persons chosen by Himmler to host the event. Benzinger was part of an elite inner circle of Luftwaffe doctors favored by the Reichsfuhrer SS, he conceded, but that was not a crime. But prosecutors also had a document that suggested Benzinger was far more implicated in the crimes than he let on. After the showing of the film, most of the spectators withdrew, and a small group of doctors remained behind, including Benzinger. They asked Rascher for a verbal report on the experiments, the document read. Benzinger insisted that all he did was listen, that there was no evidence of his having participated in any of the medical murders, and that there were no documents and no eyewitnesses that could prove otherwise. On October 12, 1946, Dr. Theodore Benzinger was announced as a defendant in the forthcoming doctor's trial. And then, just 11 days later, on October 23, 1946, Benzinger was released from the Nuremberg prison without further explanation. He was returned directly to the custody of the Army Air Forces, as stated in his declassified Nuremberg prisoner file. After spending a little over a month in the Nuremberg jail, Benzinger was back in Heidelberg continuing his U.S. Army research work. There was no explanation as to why Benzinger was dropped from the list of defendants in the upcoming doctor's trial. It would take decades for an important clue to be revealed by Nuremberg trial expert and medical history professor Paul Windling. As it turned out, in the fall of 1946, Benzinger had recently completed a paper on pilot physiology concerning stratospheric or extremely high-altitude aircraft. The U.S. Army Air Force's Wright Field circulated his report on this topic in October 1946, just weeks after his detention and release from the prison complex at the Nuremberg Palace of Justice, Windling explains. The suggestion is that perhaps someone in the Army Air Forces felt Benzinger's expertise was more in the national interest than was trying him for war crimes. One of the Nuremberg prosecutors, a Boston attorney named Alexander G. Hardy, was outraged when he learned of Benzinger's release and insisted that the interrogations were sloppy. Back at the AAF Aero Medical Center in Heidelberg, the arrest of the five doctors on war crimes charges had everyone on edge. The classified programs taking place there began to quietly wind down. While doctors Roof, Schaffer, Hermann Becker-Friesing, and Schroeder faced judgment at Nuremberg, 34 of the doctors remaining at the center prepared for shipment to the United States under Operation Paperclip. One of the first doctors in the group to head to America for work in February 1947 was Dr. Theodore Benzinger. At Nuremberg, while the doctors from Heidelberg remained incarcerated in one wing of the prison awaiting trial, preparations of another kind were also going on. The trial of the major war criminals was over. On the morning of October 1st, the judges took turns reading the verdicts. 19 convictions and 3 acquittals of the 22 accused major war criminals. One, Bormann, in absentia. That same afternoon, the tribunal pronounced what sentences would be imposed. 12 death sentences, 3 life sentences, and 4 lengthy prison terms. Albert Speer, the only defendant who pled guilty, was sentenced to 20 years. The doctors from Heidelberg were housed in a separate wing of the prison where pre-trial interviews would continue for another 2 months. Also in custody inside the prison complex at the Palace of Justice was Dr. Otto Ambrose. Ambrose would be tried in a subsequent trial, Case 6, or the Farben trial, which was scheduled to begin in the summer of 1947. As commandant of the facility, Colonel Burton Andrus was in charge of all prisoners, including those who were soon to be hanged. The condemned had roughly 2 weeks to live. Andrus described the surreal atmosphere in the last days at Nuremberg for the Nazis who had been sentenced to death. Ribbentrop, Kaltenbrunner, Frank, and Zeiss in Kvart took communion and made last confession to Father O'Connor, the Nuremberg priest. Göring bequeathed his shaving brush and razor to the prison barber. Streicher penned 6 letters. Ribbentrop read a book. Keitel requested that a German folk song be played on the organ as he was hanged. On the night of 14th October, I made arrangements for the tightest security to be put around the prison, Colonel Andrus recalled. I wanted the condemned men to know only at the very last minute that their time had come to be hanged. The Nuremberg Gymnasium was chosen as the location where the executions would take place. Each night, the U.S. Army prison guards played basketball there to blow off steam. The night before the gallows were constructed, Andrus allowed the usual game to go on. Late at night, remembered Andrus, when the sweating players had trotted off to their showers, the grim-faced execution team passed through a door specially cut into the catwalk wall and began their tasks in the gymnasium. A doorway had been cut into the blind side of the building so that no prisoner would see scaffolding being carried in. The condemned prisoners were also shielded from seeing the stretchers that would soon be carrying their corpses away. While the gallows were being built, drama unfolded in the prison. Goring had requested death by firing squad instead of hanging. To be hanged was something he considered beneath him. His plea was considered by the Allied Control Commission and rejected. The night before he was to be hanged, Goring swallowed a brass and glass vial of potassium cyanide that he had skillfully managed to keep hidden for 18 months. In a suicide note, he explained how he had managed to keep the vial hidden from guards by alternating its hiding place from his anus to his flabby navel. War crimes investigator Dr. Leopold Alexander would later learn that it was Dr. Rascher of the notorious Dachau experiments who had originally prepared Goring's suicide vial for him. Shortly after midnight, in the early morning hours of October 16, 1946, three sets of gallows had been built and painted black. Each had 13 stairs leading up to a platform and crossbeam from which a noose with 13 coils hung. The executioner was Master Sergeant John C. Woods, a man whose credentials included hanging 347 U.S. soldiers over a period of 15 years for capital crimes, including desertion. At 1 a.m., Colonel Andrus read the names of the condemned out loud. After each name, a bilingual assistant said, "Tod durch den Strang," or death by the rope. One by one, the Nazis were hanged. At 4 a.m., the bodies were loaded onto two trucks and driven to a secret location just outside Munich. Here, at what was later revealed to be the Dachau concentration camp, the bodies of these perpetrators of World War II and the Holocaust were cremated in the camp's ovens. Their ashes were raked out, scooped up, and thrown into a river. When asked by Time magazine to comment on the hangings, executioner John C. Woods had this to say, "I hanged those 10 Nazis, and I am proud of it. I wasn't nervous. A fellow can't afford to have nerves in this business. The way I look at this hanging job, somebody has to do it." So it went, just 1 year and a few months after the end of World War II. Some Nazis were hanged. Others now had lucrative new jobs. Many, like the four German doctors from the Army Air Force's Aeromedical Center at Heidelberg, now awaiting trial at Nuremberg, were in the gray area in between. Was the old German proverb true? Jedem das seine. Does everyone get what he deserves? Chapter 13. Science at Any Price. The same week that the major criminals convicted at Nuremberg were hanged and their ashes thrown into a river, Undersecretary of State Dean Acheson called Samuel Claus into his office at the State Department to discuss Operation Paperclip. At issue was the fact that JOA had circulated a new top-secret directive, JOA 257-22. The way in which paperclip participants would now receive visas had officially been changed. Instead of allowing State Department representatives to conduct pre-examinations in Europe prior to visa issuance, as was required by law, that process would be completed here in America by the Commissioner of the Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS. The Department of State would accept as final the investigation and security reports prepared by JOA for issuing final clearance of individuals concerned, wrote JOA Director Colonel Thomas Ford. Acheson and Claus were both aware that JOA had wrested control of how visas were issued and had done so in defiance of U.S. law. But the president had signed off on the directive. Operation Paperclip was now officially a denial program, meaning that any German scientist of potential interest to the Russians needed to be denied to the Russians at whatever cost. There were now 233 paperclip scientists in the United States in military custody. The State Department was told to expect to receive in the coming months their visa applications and those of their family members. The information contained within the scientists' OMGUS security dossiers promised to be the best information available. Samuel Klaus knew this vague new language meant military intelligence officers could withhold damaging information about certain scientists from State Department officials. The pipeline to bring ardent Nazis and their families into the United States was open wide. 3 weeks later, the New York Times reported for the first time that there were Nazi scientists living in America under a secret military program. Its sources were the Russian Army's Berlin-based newspaper Tägliche Rundschau and the Russian-licensed East German newspaper Berliner Zeitung. In a follow-up article, an anonymous source told the newspaper that 1,000 additional German scientists were on the way. All were described as volunteers and under contract, the article reported. Their trial periods are generally 6 months, after which they can apply for citizenship and have their dependents brought to the United States. Newsweek magazine revealed that the secret military program's classified name was Project Paperclip. Rather than deny the story, the War Department decided to go public with a sanitized version of its program. They would also make several scientists at Wright Field available to press, radio, and pictorial services. An open house was organized, with Army censors releasing details and photographs that would foster the appearance that all of the German scientists in the United States were benign. At Wright Field, the dirigible expert, Theodor Nack, gave a demonstration with a parachute. The 80-year-old Hugo Eckener, former chairman of the Zeppelin Company, explained to reporters that thanks to his new Army contract, he was now working with Goodyear on a new blimp design. Alexander Lippisch, inventor of the Messerschmitt ME-163 jet fighter, was photographed in a suit holding up a scale model of a sleek, futuristic delta-wing jet, his hawk-line nose staring down the end of the airplane. The emphasis on Lippisch was not that his jet fighter held records for Allied shootdowns in the war, but that his aircraft set international records for speed. Ernst Eckert, an expert in jet fuels, discussed high-speed gas turbines in his thick German accent. It was by mistake that the War Department allowed Eckert to chat with reporters, considering that his JOA file listed him as a Nazi ideologue and former member of the SS and the SA. The program was becoming unwieldy, and no matter how hard the JOA tried to maintain control, they could not keep an eye on all things. One American officer, assigned as a spokesman for the Germans, told reporters he so enjoyed working with German scientists, I wish we had more of them. Other German scientists at Wright Field were kept away from reporters, particularly those men who had been members of Nazi Party paramilitary squads like the SA and the SS. In aerodynamicist Rudolf Hermann's intelligence file, it was written that during the war, while working inside the wind tunnels in Kochel, Bavaria, Hermann had held morning roll calls in his brown SA uniform and that he often gave speeches in support of Hitler. The information in engineer Emil Salmon's OMGUS security report was even more incriminating. At the aircraft factory where he had worked, Salmon had been known to carry a rifle and wear an SS uniform. He also belonged to the Stormtroops, SA, from 1933 to 1945, and held the position of troop leader, Truppführer, read one memo. When bringing him to America, the Army stated, this command is cognizant of Mr. Salmon's Nazi activities and certain allegations made by some of his associates in Europe. namely that during the war, Emil Salman had been involved in burning down a synagogue in his hometown of Ludwigshafen. But Emil Salman was now at right field because the Army Air Forces found his knowledge and expertise difficult, if not impossible, to duplicate. Emil Salman built aircraft engine test stands. For various press events, the Army provided photographs of some of the more wholesome-looking German scientists, definitely no one with a dueling scar. There were pictures of white-haired men playing chess, window shopping outside a Dayton, Ohio toy store, smoking cigarettes, and sunning themselves on Army grounds. To be invited to the open house, a reporter had to agree in advance to clear his or her story with Army censors before going to press. The military placed its own article in the Stars and Stripes, purporting to tell the official story. None of the Germans had ever been Nazis. The men were under strict supervision here in the United States. They were all outstanding scientists and technicians, vital to national security. They were moral family men. The news stories about the scientists at Wright Field generated a flurry of response, including newspaper editorials and letters to congressmen. A Gallup poll the following week revealed that most Americans believed that bringing 1,000 more German scientists to America was a bad idea. Journalist and foreign affairs correspondent Joachim Josten was outraged by the very idea of paperclip, writing in The Nation, "If you enjoy mass murder but also treasure your skin, be a scientist, son. It's the only way, nowadays, of getting away with murder." Rabbi Stephen S. Wise, president of the American Jewish Congress, penned a scathing letter to Secretary of War Patterson that was made public. "As long as we reward former servants of Hitler while leaving his victims in DP, displaced persons, camps, we cannot even pretend that we are making any real effort to achieve the aims we fought for." Eleanor Roosevelt became personally involved in protesting Operation Paperclip, organizing a conference at the Waldorf Astoria Hotel with Albert Einstein as honored guest. The former First Lady urged the United States government to suspend visas for all Germans for 12 years. When professors at Syracuse University learned that a new colleague, Dr. Heinz Fischer, an expert in infrared technology and a former member of the Nazi Party, had been sent by the Army to work in one of their university laboratories under a secret military contract, they wrote an editorial for the New York Times. "We object not because they are citizens of an enemy nation, but because they were and probably still are Nazis." The Society for the Prevention of World War III, a group of several thousand writers, artists, scholars, and journalists, did not mince words in their December journal. The group had been set up during the war to advocate for harsh, punitive measures against a nation they perceived as inherently aggressive and militaristic, and against individuals they believed had substantially profited from the Nazi regime. These German experts performed wonders for the German war effort. Can one forget their gas chambers, their skill in cremation, their meticulous methods used to extract gold from the teeth of their victims, their wizardry in looting and thieving? The Society, which counted William L. Shire and Daryl Zanuck among its members, urged all fellow Americans to contact the War Department and demand that Hitler's scientists be sent home. One engineer at Wright Field actually was about to be sent home. But tunnel engineer George Riquet's downfall came not because of the demands made by the public, but because of the actions by a fellow German. In the fall of 1946, of the 233 Nazi scientists in America, 140 were at Wright Field. With that many single men living together in isolation, the hilltop became divided into social cliques. The Nazi businessman, Albert Patin, continued to serve as Colonel Putt's ears and eyes among the Germans, reporting to Putt about the Germans' needs and complaints. In this arrangement, Patin wielded power at the hilltop. With the arrival of former Mittelwerk general manager George Ricke in the summer of 1946, Albert Patin saw a business opportunity. Ricke was a former employee of the Speer Ministry. He served as the general manager of the Mittelwerk slave labor facility in Nordhausen, where the V-2 rockets were built. Colonel Beasley of the United States Strategic Bombing Survey had evacuated Ricke to London, and after that work was completed, Ricke was hired to work at Wright Field. When asked by military intelligence officers what his job was, Ricke said, "Giving my knowledge and experience in regard to planning, construction, and operating underground factories." George Ricke was a tunnel engineer, and his value to the U.S. military was the knowledge he had gained while overseeing vast underground building projects for the Reich. A memo in Ricke's dossier, written by the Army's Office of the Deputy Director of Intelligence, kept his most powerful negotiating secret a secret. He was in charge of all tunnel operations directly under Hitler's headquarters in Berlin. George Ricke had overseen the building of the Führer Bunker, where Hitler lived the last 3 months and 2 weeks of his life. With its more than 30 rooms, crypt-like corridors, multiple emergency exits, and hundreds of stairs, all located more than 30 feet under Berlin, the Führer Bunker was considered an engineering tour de force. The Army was impressed by how well Hitler's Führer Bunker had withstood years of heavy Allied bombing and was interested in learning from George Ricke how to build similar underground command centers of its own. As the Cold War progressed, the U.S. Army would begin the secret construction of such facilities, notably ones that could continue to function in the aftermath of a chemical, biological, or nuclear attack. It would take several decades for journalists to reveal that starting in the early 1950s, several sprawling, multi-floor, underground command centers had been secretly built for this purpose, including one in the Catoctin Mountains, called Raven Rock Mountain Complex, or Site R, and another in the Blue Ridge Mountains, called Mount Weather. George Ricke's expertise in underground engineering was not limited to the construction of the Führer Bunker. During the war, he had also served as a director of the Reich's DMAG Motor Car Company, where he oversaw the construction of a massive underground facility where tanks had been assembled. And as general manager of the Mittelwerk, he oversaw the construction of the rocket assembly facility near Nordhausen. In his Army intelligence dossier, it was noted that Ricke had overseen the underground construction of more than 1,500,000 square feet of space. At Wright Field, Ricke was meant to start consulting with American engineers on underground engineering projects for the Army. But that work was slow, and Ricke was given a second job. Despite poor English skills, Ricke was put in charge of examining V-2 documents captured at Nordhausen, and, in his words, the rendering of opinions on reports. In the late summer of 1946, Albert Patin and George Ricke started running a black market operation at the hilltop, selling booze and cigarettes to their colleagues at premium prices. Ricke had years of experience in wartime black market operations. Military intelligence would later learn that during the war, what little rations the slave laborers were allotted by the Speer Ministry, Ricke would sometimes sell off at a price. At Wright Field, Ricke and Patin's black market business quickly expanded, and the men enlisted outside assistance from Riquet's sister, Adelheid Riquet, who was living in a hotel in New Jersey at the time. Adelheid Riquet agreed to move to Ohio to help the men expand their black market business into Dayton and beyond. Because the Germans' mail was monitored, it did not take long for the higher-ups at Wright Field to learn what was going on. But the Army Air Forces took no action against either man. The business continued into the fall of 1946 when it came to a head. In their private time, Riquet and Patin liked to gamble. They also liked to drink. The two men regularly hosted parties at the Hilltop, staying up late drinking and playing cards. One night, in the fall of 1946, a 63-year-old German aircraft engineer named Hermann Nielsen decided he'd had enough. It was a little after midnight during the second week of October when Riquet, Albert Patin, and a third man were playing cards. The noise woke up Hermann Nielsen, who knocked on the door and told the three card players to quiet down. After Nielsen's second request was ignored, he opened the door, walked into the room, and turned off the lamp on the card table. Riquet, by Nielsen's account, was drunk. As Nielsen was leaving, Riquet lit a candle and laughed at his German colleague. "A man could still play cards with a good kosher candle," Riquet joked. The incident was a tipping point for Hermann Nielsen, and he went to Colonel Putt to file a formal complaint against the two men. There was more to the story, Nielsen told Colonel Putt. Riquet was a war criminal. He had been the primary person behind a mass hanging at Nordhausen, the hanging by crane of a dozen prisoners, and had bragged about it on the ship ride coming over to the United States. As for Albert Patin, Hermann Nielsen told Colonel Putt he was an ardent Nazi as well, a member of the SA. Patin's companies used slave laborers from concentration camps. What Hermann Nielsen did not know was that Colonel Putt was not interested in the past histories of the German scientists in the Army Air Force's employ, or that Putt had a gentleman's agreement with Albert Patin and had been using him to keep an eye on the other Germans at the Hilltop. Colonel Putt said he would look into the allegations. Instead, Putt had Nielsen watched for future security violations. Hermann Nielsen remained angry about the incident and wrote so in a letter to a friend in New York City named Erwin Lowy. Perhaps Nielsen knew that all of his mail was read by military screeners, or maybe he did not. Either way, what Nielsen wrote to Lowy caught the eye of Wright Field mail censors. Nielsen's letter was turned over to the intelligence division to be analyzed. Several weeks later, Hermann Nielsen violated security and left Wright Field for a weekend visit with a relative in Michigan. Colonel Putt reported the violation to Air Material Command headquarters and arranged to have Nielsen transferred to Mitchell Field, an Air Force base in New York. But Hermann Nielsen's letter to Erwin Lowy about George Riquet had a life of its own. It made its way to Army Air Force's headquarters in Washington, D.C., where it was read by Colonel Millard Lewis, Executive Assistant Chief of Air Staff, too. The allegations were serious, Colonel Lewis decided. They involved alleged war crimes. Lewis sent a memorandum to the Director of Intelligence for the War Department General Staff, summarizing the situation and advising that an investigating officer be assigned to look into the matter. Mr. Nielsen stated that Dr. George Riquet, age 47, specialist in the field of engineering and production of guided missiles, was employed in the underground plant at Nordhausen as a strong Nazi Party member, where in 1944, 12 foreign workers were strung up on a crossbeam and raised by a crane in the presence of the group of workers and killed, read Colonel Lewis's memorandum. One of the group, who acted as an observer, asserted that Dr. Riquet was the chief instigator for the execution. The Pentagon assigned an Air Corps major named Eugene Smith to look into the George Rickey case. Back at Wright Field, Colonel Putt likely believed that the allegations against Rickey had fallen by the wayside. Meanwhile, Hermann Nielsen had been banished to Mitchell Field. In January 1947, Putt recommended that Rickey be given a long-term military contract for employment at Wright Field. That request was authorized, and on April 12, 1947, George Rickey signed a new 5-year contract with the War Department. Separately, and without Putt's knowledge, the Rickey investigation was moving forward. At Army Air Force's headquarters in Washington, Major Eugene Smith made preparations to travel to various military bases for interviews. It was Smith's job to talk to Rickey's former colleagues from Nordhausen, to write up his findings, and to file a report. Colonel Putt did not learn about this investigation until Major Smith arrived at Wright Field. Putt suggested Major Smith discuss Rickey's case with Captain Albert Abels, the officer in charge of the paperclip scientists at the Hilltop, so that Abels could clear things up. Abels told Major Smith that the stories were petty jealousy between scientists, just gossip among men. Major Smith was unconvinced. He headed to Mitchell Field to interview Hermann Nielsen and other German scientists who might have knowledge regarding the Rickey case. Hermann Nielsen stood by his original story. In 1944, 12 foreign workers were simultaneously hanged by being strung up on a crossbeam and raised by a crane in the presence of the workers, Nielsen wrote in an affidavit. Dr. Rickey was the chief instigator for the execution, meaning it was Rickey's idea to hang the men. A second witness emerged at Mitchell Field, a former engineer on the Nordhausen rocket assembly lines named Werner Voss. Voss also testified that Rickey was involved in the hangings, and he provided important new details that added context to the executions. Shortly before the hangings, Voss said, British airplanes had dropped leaflets urging the Nordhausen slave laborers to revolt. A group of them did revolt, and those men were among the ones hanged. The execution was a public event, Voss said, meant to intimidate other slave workers into subservience. These were serious allegations of war crimes. Major Smith needed corroboration, and for that, he headed to Fort Bliss, Texas. Smith had been told by the Army that he would be able to interview Wernher von Braun, as well as some of the other men who had worked closely with George Rickey inside the Nordhausen tunnels. At Fort Bliss, in the evenings, the German rocket specialists gathered in a clubhouse built in a grove of cottonwood trees. There, they played cards while drinking American cocktails and beer. They strung hammocks between the trees and enjoyed balmy desert nights. Once a month, most of the Germans went into El Paso as a group to shop and have a restaurant meal. The nightmarish environment at Nordhausen, which the majority of the rocket engineers had participated in, must have seemed like another world, until Major Smith arrived to take official depositions for the U.S. Army and asked the men to recollect what those days had been like. Major Smith's first interviews would be with Wernher von Braun and his brother, Magnus von Braun. But after Major Smith arrived at Fort Bliss, he was told that both von Braun brothers were out of town. Smith interviewed Günther Haukohl instead. Haukohl had been the original designer of the Nordhausen rocket assembly line and, like Wernher von Braun, was an officer with the SS. Günther Haukohl told Major Smith that he had no clear memories about what had happened in the tunnels in the last months of the war. But yes, prisoners were abused. Rickey's involvement is probably a rumor, Haukohl said. V-2 engineers Hans Pallero and Rudolf Schlitt seconded Haukel's position, repeating the idea that the end of the war was nothing but a blur. Engineer Eric Ball, who also worked on the rocket assembly lines at Nordhausen, told Major Smith that he had witnessed two sets of prisoner hangings in the tunnels, but that George Rickey had not been involved in either of them. Major Smith accepted that the men might not be able to remember details about what had gone on, but surely, as engineers, they could remember the layout of the facility. Smith asked Haukel, Schlitt, Pallero, and Ball to use their engineers' precision and help him create an accurate illustration of the workspaces inside the Nordhausen tunnels, including where the rockets were assembled and where the hangings occurred. This was an important artifact for the investigation. Next, Major Smith interviewed the former Middlework Operations Director, Arthur Rudolph. Like George Rickey, Arthur Rudolph had authority over the Middleworks Prison Labor Supply Office, which was the unit responsible for getting food rations to the slave laborers. In his interview, Arthur Rudolph first denied ever seeing prisoners abused. Major Smith showed Arthur Rudolph the illustration that had been drawn by Rudolph's Nordhausen colleagues, Haukel, Schlitt, Pallero, and Ball. Major Smith pointed out to Arthur Rudolph that Rudolph's office was directly adjacent to where the 12 so-called political prisoners had been hanged from the crane. As Arthur Rudolph continued to deny ever seeing prisoners abused, Smith found his testimony increasingly suspicious. Everyone else interviewed admitted to having seen some prisoner abuse. Rudolph was adamant. "I did not see them punished, beaten, hung, or shot," he told Major Smith. Smith approached the question in a different manner. He asked Rudolph if he could recall anything about the 12 men who had been hanged from the crane. This public execution, Smith said, had been confirmed by many of Rudolph's colleagues, and Smith was trying to put together an accurate portrait of what had happened and when. Rudolph replied, "One dying prisoner lifted his knees after I got there." In other words, Rudolph had witnessed the executions. Major Smith was now convinced that the truth about what happened at Nordhausen was being covered up collectively by the group, and that Arthur Rudolph knew a lot more than he let on. But as Smith noted in his report, the subject of the investigation was George Rickey, not Arthur Rudolph. Mr. Rudolph impressed the undersigned as a very clever, shrewd individual, Smith wrote. He did not wish to become involved in any investigations that might involve him in any way with illegal actions in the underground factory, and as a result, was cautious of his answers. Smith returned to Washington and advised U.S. Army Air Force's headquarters of his findings. In Germany, a serendipitous incident occurred at this same time. William Almans, the Dutch citizen who had been working on the U.S. war crimes investigation team, had been hunting down SS officers from Dora Nordhausen for an upcoming regional war crimes trial. Almans had managed to locate only 11 out of 3,000 SS officers who had run the concentration camp. Almans was the man who had interviewed many of the newly liberated prisoners back in April 1945. And he was also the individual who had found the Middlework employee telephone list tacked to the tunnel wall. The two names at the top of that list were George Rickey and Arthur Rudolph. Almans had no idea that both men had been recruited into Operation Paperclip. In Germany, no one Almans interviewed claimed to know the whereabouts of either man. Then, one afternoon in May 1947, Almans was taking a break from his Nazi hunting work, reading the Stars and Stripes newspaper in the sunshine, when, as he told journalist Tom Bauer decades later, "I just saw a tiny headline. German scientist applies for American citizenship. The name mentioned was George Ricke, Almonds explained. I screamed for joy and rushed into the head office